Well, we begin with a quiz. What's the first of the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Right. What's the last of the Ten Commandments? You shall not covet. That's right. So the very first one, have no other gods before me. And the last is, you shall not covet. You know, the previous commands that we find in the Ten Commandments, beginning with the first, down through the ninth, they're commands that really talk of our actions and our words, what our actions and words, what they are to be, how we are to express ourselves and speak about others. But this last one, you shall not covet, it's different. It deals with what's going on inside of us. I mean, what's going on inside of us will dictate how it is that we deal with the other nine. But this particular one deals with what's going on inside of you. You shall not covet anything that is your neighbor's. And when you think about coveting, I mean, what is that? That's an interior attitude. That's a thought. That looks at what somebody else has and says, I want that. Or they shouldn't have that. I should have that. I desire that. And what does covetousness then reveal? It reveals discontent. There's something in our own life, in our own understanding about how we exist that we're discontent with. We are just simply not pleased with the state of affairs. We want what the other has, and so thinking, if we had it, we would be content. Paul speaks, put to death what is earthly in you? Sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. That's an interesting statement. Covetousness is idolatry. And why would that be? Well, if we take the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, and you take the last, you shall not covet what is your neighbor's, we put those together, and what does covetousness suggest is that somehow this God that I am supposed to have alone in my life just isn't coming through. He isn't providing as I expect him to. And so I'm going to look to another God. I'm going to look to someone else who might provide for me as I think I ought to provide. I mean, it's just not just what God is doing. He's allowing that other person to have that, and he's not allowing me to have it. That's why some people refer to the first and the tenth as the bookends of the law, not so much just because they are the first and the last, but because they encompass all of it. If we have no other gods but God, then we will not be coveting what other people have, because we will be serving that God, we'll be worshiping that God, we'll be thankful for that God, we'll be trusting in that God, not in the God who we think will do a better job. This relationship between our devotion to God and our desire for things, I think it's at the heart of this passage from Luke that we're looking at now. You know, we've been working our way through the Gospel of Luke, and we're now in chapter 12. And we've already considered last week how it is that Jesus expects his followers to confess him before the world. And to do that, even if there is persecution forthcoming, even if it will cause them to suffer, they are still yet to remain faithful to Christ and to confess him. He says this, I tell you, everyone who acknowledges me before men, the Son of Man will also acknowledge before the angels of God. But the one who denies me before men will be denied before the angels of God. And this is a reference when he uses Son of Man, if you recall when we've encountered that title that Jesus uses. It's a reference to Daniel chapter 7, when this figure, this one who's a figure that is both divine and human, comes into the courts of heaven, the books are open, judgment is given, and this one is going to be the one who will receive all authority and dominion. And we'll touch on that again a bit later. So there in the courts of heaven, What Jesus is saying, if the disciple of Jesus remains faithful, confesses him no matter what the circumstance, there in the courts of heaven before the judgment seat of God, the roll call of persevering saints will be read, and they'll receive that well done, good and faithful servant. See, what this speaks of is this speaks of a reality of a day when there will be a final reckoning. And that That view, that understanding of reality is still in play at this portion of Luke that we're considering today. There will be a day of reckoning. And the important thing to remember about that day, the important thing is to understand it is the most significant day that will be part of your existence, part of anyone's existence. That day of reckoning will be the most significant day. Why? Because it is the day that all of history is moving toward. It's the day that is coming and is the reason why Jesus came from heaven, took on our existence, suffered and died. Why? Because there's going to be a day of reckoning. And that day will be one when all will have to come before the judgment seat of God and give an account of their life. God has put his law out and told us how it is that we're supposed to live. And when we fall short of that, it will be known on that day. In fact, Jesus said right in the last week, there's nothing hidden that won't be made known. So that day of judgment, that day of reckoning, is the most significant that for any human being that has ever existed or will ever exist. And that day, the reality of that day, it should shape our understanding of ourselves and how we live our lives and how we spend the time, how we utilize the hours that are given to us here on this earth. And that is what Jesus is driving at in this passage before us today. Now, in this passage today, we have this interruption. It feels like an interruption when one reads it. You know, the crowds are there, Jesus is teaching, and suddenly, out of the crowd, this person asks this question of Jesus, makes this demand of Jesus. He says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Apparently, rabbis might stand in such a position to make that kind of decision. But Jesus is reading something into this. He sees something about this man's attitude, hears this in his voice. He says, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" See, it's clear that the questioner has a grievance against his brother. And we don't know the circumstances, but by Jesus' reaction, subsequent teaching, we can reasonably surmise that Jesus feels the man's cause is unjust. He says to them, "Take care, be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." Right, so the man asks the question, divide the inheritance. Jesus says, "Listen, I'm not taking that on, but let me tell you something. Be on guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." And then he goes on to talk about a rich fool. He tells this in a parable. He told him a parable saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I'll do this. I'll tear down my barns, build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" You see why I understand why it is that this day of reckoning is the most important day for a person. And that our awareness of it should shape our understanding of ourselves and how we live our lives and the time that we have here on this earth. I mean, here's a life out of which the reality of God has been completely crowded out. The life of this rich fool. He's focused on himself and his possessions and his pleasure. He's the master of his fate. He's the shaper of his destiny, without calculating that his fate might be that he dies on the very same day in which he's making his plans for the future, and that his destiny is not ease and comfort, but the torments of hell. See, Jesus' descriptive language points out the blindness of the one who lives like this. What does he say? The land of a rich man produced plentifully. He was a man who owned land. Not a bad thing. One of the commandments is, thou shalt not steal. It recognizes the right of owning personal property. He sowed and farmed the land. Also, not a bad thing. The potential of the earth was meant to be leveraged so it would produce those kinds of crops. But he can do nothing more than that, can he? It's God who supplies the sun and the rain. He's built into the ground the minerals needed for the crops to grow. And in fact, he's the one who created everything in the first place, including the mechanisms by which the crops grow. But the man is blinded to those realities by the possibilities that his newfound wealth has brought him. I'm going to store these crops. I'm going to live comfortably off of them for many years, and I'll say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But Jesus puts this man's existence in perspective. He does it for all of our existence. He puts all of our existence in perspective when he closes the parable with this. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? What's the old joke? How much did John Rockefeller leave when he died? All of it. Steve Jobs died recently. He left behind apparently $9 million. Somebody bemoaned the fact that it could have been $127 million if he hadn't sold all of his Apple stock. But no matter how much he left, when Steve Jobs died, he left it all. And no amount of money, worldly possessions in this life is going to serve him, John Rockefeller, or anybody when they stand naked before God and asked to give an accounting of their existence. See, Jesus speaks elsewhere of this deceitfulness of riches. He speaks of it, the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things enter in and choke out the revealed truth about God. And makes it unfruitful in someone's life. And isn't that what happened, right, to this person who Jesus portrayed? The bounty before his eyes blinded him to the revealed truth about God, even that which is revealed to the things that God has made. Right? As Paul says, right? God is revealed. We are without excuse. And the things that he has made, he is revealed. And certainly this man should have understood that. He owned land, he planted seed, and then he watched the rain fall from heaven. He watched the sun shine, the crops came up, and it yielded a bountiful harvest. But somehow, the harvest that it produced, the riches that came into him, the wealth, deceived him into thinking that he had many more days, that he could live a life of comfort and ease. And God comes along and says, you don't understand. Tonight, your soul is required of you. So this is when Jesus turns to the crowd in the wake of this man who asked him to intervene. And he tells them to be aware of covetousness. Take care, be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Now, given this parable, what do we think that Jesus means by that last phrase, one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions? I mean, isn't he intimating that life does not end when we breathe our last? There's more to life than our earthly riches. And the one who doesn't understand this or keep it before his eyes is like the fool in the parable. He's not investing in the eternal kingdom. He's not, as he says, rich toward God. And again, that's why I suggested at the beginning that the first and the last commandments that address our devotion to God and our desire for things are at the heart of this teaching. If we keep God in his proper place, then we will not be focused on the things of this earth as though they are our comfort, they are our assurance. It is in them that we live and move and have our being. No, it's in God and God alone where we find our existence. But Jesus does go on to acknowledge a very real cause for desiring earthly possessions, and that is the fear of want. The fear of not having what we need. See, the fool in the parable feels secure because of his wealth, and that's not an uncommon response. But Jesus instructs his disciples that their security is not in gathering possessions, and indeed it should not be. because riches can be deceiving, as was shown by the fool in the parable. Their security is in being focused on God and submitting their lives to him and pursuing his will, his kingdom. Jesus says it this way, that we are to be rich toward God, providing for ourselves money bags that do not grow old. Now, how can we learn to do this? How is it that we can learn to trust God for our security? Right? If it is the fact that we covet possessions, we desire possessions in order that we might have confidence, secure, that we'll be provided for, we'll be taken care of, and yet we're told that's not where our focus should be, how is it that we can learn to trust God for this? Well, Jesus says, look around you. Look at what God has made. Consider the ravens. He says, they neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouses nor barns, yet God feeds them. How much more value are you than birds, he says. And then he says, look at the fields. Look at the grass of the fields. Look what God adorns the grass of the fields with. Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass, which is alive in the field today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? Look around. See how God provides. See what he has done to provide for birds and for a field to be beautifully laden out with flowers. And how valuable are you? How valuable are you to God? Well, we know that indeed he gave his only son to provide a righteousness that will allow us to stand on that day of reckoning. Right? The problem we've got is that day is coming and we need to live in the light of it and understand it. But what do we do? How will we stand on that day? Well, God says he loves us. In fact, he loves us so much that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes in him would not perish but have everlasting life. God did not spare his own son but gave him up for us all. So we are indeed valuable to God, so much so that he was allowing his own son to shed his precious blood to redeem us. So that on that day, we might be able to stand on that day of reckoning, not having to give an account from our own life, but being able to point to Christ and say, he is my accounting. He is my perfect life. He is my ultimate righteousness. How much more value are you than the birds or the grass? You're so valuable, Jesus says. You're so valuable that God, my Father, has sent me here to live the existence that you cannot in order that I might die in your place, to rise again from the dead, and to receive victory over sin and death. See, on that day, we will be able to stand in Christ's perfect life and not in our imperfect one. So, he says, look around. Understand how valuable you are to God. And then to understand that what he offers to us is his kingdom. He says, do not seek what you are to eat and what you are to drink, nor be worried, for all the nations of the world seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. See, a Christian can have confidence not just in God's ability to provide, but in his desire to provide. Jesus says, fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. God's intention has been to make them part of the kingdom. It's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Now, what kingdom is being spoken of? Well, I would suggest, given the context of Luke and how Jesus' self-designation of the Son of Man is his favorite one, it again relates back to this Daniel chapter 7. I saw in the night visions, behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days, was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. The Father's good pleasure is to give you the kingdom. He's saying that they have a part in this everlasting dominion, a kingdom that shall not be destroyed. And is that something more than what riches can accumulate on earth, can buy for you? Is that something more that can be secured through how much possession you have? No. It is only through faith in the one who was sent out of God's love to redeem us so that we might be able to stand on that day of reckoning. Now, given that destiny, versus the destiny of the rich fool, it makes sense, as Jesus says, to do what is necessary to keep ourselves from covetousness. Right? What was the question initially that started this whole dialogue? The question was, teacher, tell my brother to give me half of the inheritance. And Jesus goes on to talk about this rich fool who has his eyes focused on the wealth that is before him and all the security and blessings and ease that it's going to bring him. And Jesus says, you're investing in the wrong kingdom. You're investing in the wrong place. You're investing here on earth when you should be investing in heaven. And in fact, if your possessions, if you're like that rich fool, that your possessions are getting in your way, you don't understand the reality that awaits you. You don't understand that on the day of reckoning, you're going to need something more than these full barns and these storehouses that are bursting with crops. What you're going to need is you're going to need God himself to redeem you, to save you. And if your possessions are getting in your way, what does he say in verse 33? Sell your possessions. Sell them. Give to the needy. How might the man have responded to the abundant wealth that had become his? What might he have done rather than saying, I've got it made for the next years? Well, if he was rich toward God, if God's kingdom were his priority, if he understood that life is more than food, as Jesus says, and the body more than clothing, if he trusted that God knew that what he needed, and that he would provide what he needed, he could have said this: Lord, what shall I do with this tremendous wealth that you have given me? How might I further the work of your kingdom with these riches? Whose poverty and hunger might I alleviate? See, if one's heart is for God and not for himself, this is how one can respond. For Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And if you understand that God himself and the purpose that he has for you and the will that he is working on is the thing of greatest value, the greatest treasure, if that's where your heart is, then our perspective is corrected. And our eyes are lifted up to him. And then our days are lived out accordingly. Moses says in his psalm, in his prayer in Psalm 90, recorded in Psalm 90, he says, Lord, teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. In that psalm, he talks about the eternality of God compared to our temporality. That is, God is who he is, and he exists forever. And our life is like just a brief span. And Moses prays, God, teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. We have only so many days. How should we live these days? And when we put our possessions into the middle of that, that's where the challenge is. There's something about our possessions that cause us to get anxious, to get worried. We are either worried about it or we are allured by them. I think it's something that has to do with the fall. Something's gotten into our natures, and it's always lurking around. Remember what transpired when the woman saw that the tree was good for food. This was the tree that they were not supposed to eat from. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and the tree was be desire to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Ah, there is the root of covetousness right there. And it just lingers. It lurks. It just stays within us. And the things of this world in which we will find our fulfillment, our security, our advancement, our sense of self-fulfillment, All the things that the Adam and Eve thought that they would find by eating of this tree, they still have that power. Possessions and wealth still has that power to make us feel like that. But if we are rich towards God, if God's kingdom is our priority, if we understand that life is more than food and the body more than clothing, and if we trust that God knows what we need and he'll provide for what we need, then we will look upon our possessions as something that God wants us to use as the steward uses his property. Who is a steward? A steward is a man who has been given authority over the property of another in order to use it wisely, to bring a return for the master, but also to take care of everyone else that's underneath that master's care. So a good steward will make sure that the cattle are taken care of, that the fields are taken care of, the money's handled well, the accounts are paid for, so that the steward will live, everybody else under the master's care will live, and the master himself will be pleased with the return. That's what the fool didn't understand. That the wealth that had come to him as though it had been given to him by a wealthy man who had given it to him and said, now, be a good steward over what I've given to you. Instead, he looks upon them as something which he has complete and unchecked authority to use as he wishes, but most of all, something which will determine how his life will go. And God says we need to be rather rich towards him, to invest in his kingdom, to heed his call. And he will provide everything else for us. If one's heart is for God and not for himself, then Jesus' words, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also, will be evident in how we live our lives. You know, we have been reading a book here at Neighborhood Church called For the Glory, and it's about Eric Little. He was the fellow that the movie Chariots of Fire was, he was one of the characters in that. And if you've been reading this, you know that he was a son of a missionary, and he felt the call to go to China as a missionary. And yet he was also very fast. And so he competed, he trained and he competed for the Olympics. And indeed, he won medals in the Olympics, and great acclaim came to him. Everybody thought that, you know, there's no way he was gonna win the way he did, but he won just in extraordinary fashion. And at that moment, he had a decision: Do I find my fulfillment in being known as this fast runner, or do I find my fulfillment in being faithful to the call that God has upon me? Listen to what his biographer Duncan Hamilton has to say. Little broke away from the athletics at the peak of his flight. Sportsmen who reach the summit of their sport usually try to cling on there until their fingernails bleed. Well in advance of the Olympics, Little had talked of his intention to abdicate gracefully because his real calling was elsewhere. For most of us, that would be an easy vow to make before we became somebody, and even easier to break after the blandishments and the fancy trimmings of fame seduced us. Little never let it happen to him. He had promises to keep, that he kept them then and also subsequently as a testament to exceptionally rare qualities and an exceptionally rare individual. Overnight, Little could have become one of the richest of amateur sportsmen, but he wouldn't accept offers to write newspaper columns or make public speeches for cash. He wouldn't say yes to prestigious teaching sinecures, refusing the benefits of a smart address and a high salary. He wouldn't endorse products. He wouldn't be flattered into business or banking either. He made only trivial concessions to his celebrity. He allowed his portrait to be painted, and he let a gardener name a gladiolus in his honor at the Royal Horticultural Show. And everything else, Little followed his conscience, choosing to do what was right, because to do anything else, he felt, would sully the gift God had given him to run fast. Interesting. You know, I hesitated before including that assessment of Little. I think it's apt to what we're talking about, but it can also make us think that the only way we live by the challenges of this passage in Luke is to follow Little's footsteps and leave everything behind and go to the remotest and most difficult parts of the earth. He did that because he knew that is what God desired of him. And he would not be deceived by riches, the riches of money or the riches of notoriety. And God's not asking you to take some vow of poverty. He doesn't ask anyone to do this, frankly. And he's not asking you to sell your business or empty your bank accounts. What he is asking you is to be what little was over his talents, a good steward. A good steward of what he brings into your life. Listen again to what Hamilton Duncan says. Little followed his conscience, choosing to do what was right because to do anything else he felt would sully the gift God had given him to run fast. He knew that he could run fast, that this was something that God had given him to do. And he had done it well, and there was yet more work to be able to do that God wanted of him. And to take the notoriety that would have come from the running would somehow to be sully that gift that God had given to him. To be faithful to what God had asked, it was to follow through on the call and not be lured by the riches that were being offered. See, he had a God-given ability that he wanted to use in the way that would be rich toward God. And frankly, we don't need to necessarily have to follow a call to the remotest parts, difficult areas, war-torn parts of China. We have that opportunity every day. Every day to think about the day that we are given, the hours that we are given, as Moses has prayed. Teach us to number our days so we may gain a heart of wisdom. How is it that we will use this day, what we have within our lives, to the glory of God, to make that investment into the kingdom? But as Jesus warns, material possessions present a particular challenge. And I think indeed it is due to what happened there back in the Garden of Eden. So listen to what Paul says in Timothy chapter 6 to Timothy. He says, there is great gain in godliness with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of it. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. You know, we've read that account from Naboth's vineyard when Ahab looked upon it and wanted it because it was near his property and he wanted to have a garden that was close to him. And so he thinks he makes a reasonable deal to Naboth. And Naboth says, no, I can't give you. This is my inheritance. This is my family's inheritance. I've been given a stewardship over this property. I can't let you have it. And it eats away. It eats away at Ahab. So much so that he becomes sick. He lies in his bed. He turns his face to the wall. He mopes. And his wife, lovely Jezebel, comes along and says, what's the matter, honey? And he says, Naboth won't give me that property. She says, I'll take care of it for you. She has him murdered. See, what does Paul say? The desire to be rich, to falls into temptation, to a snare, to many senseless, harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. Material possessions and do present a very particular challenge. But Jesus says we can trust God for what we need. That he will provide for us. And again, it's not a call to poverty. It doesn't have to empty your bank accounts, but it is a willingness to trust God and to be generous with what he brings into our life, to think about how God might want us to use what he has given to us so that he will be glorified, that his kingdom will advance, that the mercy and grace and generosity of God exemplified in the giving of his son will be reflected in your own life as you give generously. As you reach out and help someone else with the material possessions that you have, that you are willing to share with others what God has so graciously given to you. This might require some changes in your priorities. It might make you have to rethink about what your future looks like. It might be that you have to just trust God more for what it is that is yours for you to use as you go forward in the remaining days of your life. But the important thing about it is that our hope, our security, our confidence is in God and not in what we have. When we stand before God, we'll be standing there alone unless we have Christ with us. Unless we have his righteousness to clothe us on that day of reckoning, we will be found wanting. And there's no pointing back and saying, look how much I acquired. Look how much I accomplished. God will look upon you and say, where is your righteousness? And we will be able, by the grace of God, if you have faith in Christ, if he has redeemed you through his blood, you'll have the ability to turn and say, Father, there is my righteousness. In your son, that is my righteousness. I'm willing to call all things loss that I might have him as my righteousness. So the day of reckoning, I'm suggesting, is a very important consideration for us and is meant to shape how it is that we think about ourselves and about our existence here on the earth. And God wants us to keep it before our eyes as we go through our day-to-day living and think about our relationship to this world in which we find ourselves. How is it that we are storing up treasures in heaven so that on that day, that reward, that well done, faithful servant will be ours in a way that will ring through the courts of heaven, that Jesus will confess us before the angels of God. We'll do that by holding fast to him no matter what the persecution or difficulties that come, but also by how it is that we live realizing how God has provided for us and will provide for us so that he will be glorified in us. Let's pray.